kept order. So a lot of people were ready to welcome this new prince. Now, Stephen, for his part, is getting tired of the struggle. And then disaster strikes. His oldest son, Eustace, his favored heir, dies suddenly. And the fight seems to go out of Stephen. And so Stephen and the young Henry made an agreement that Henry would succeed to the throne when Stephen died. And this is really quite amazing. The two men, King Stephen and Prince Henry, went around England on a sort of tour to show the flag and drum up support for this agreement about the succession. Nevertheless, it was precarious, and it was on the verge of collapsing again the following year, 1154, when all of a sudden Stephen died. And thus, Henry succeeded to the throne of England, probably sooner than he expected. He becomes Henry II, and there's barely a whisper of opposition. And he rules for the next 35 years, from 1154 to 1189, exactly as long as his grandfather, Henry I. So, what's he like? Now, when I imagine Henry II of England, I always picture Peter O'Toole, who played the king in two famous movies. The first one was called Becket, where he played opposite Richard Burton. Richard Burton is playing the martyred Archbishop of Canterbury. The second of these movies is The Lion in Winter, where he's playing opposite Katharine Hepburn, possibly one of the only women in history who is just as formidable as the queen she's portraying, Eleanor of Aquitaine. Now, just like Peter O'Toole, Henry II is larger than life, and he has a very long and complicated reign, and for that reason, we're going to spend two full lectures on it, just as it merited two films. In the first lecture, I'm going to deal largely with Henry, the law and order man, the Henry of the film Becket. And this is a king who engages in passionate efforts to concentrate legal authority in royal hands. And this leads directly to the epic struggle with Thomas Becket. In the second lecture, I'm going to look at Henry as the head of a dynasty, the Henry of the Lion in Winter. He rules a sprawling collection of territories in England and France, but he has a very unruly family, and this family includes four notoriously disloyal sons and one very aggrieved wife. And it turns out to be Henry's tragedy that his bitterest enemies are first of all his former best friend and Chancellor Thomas Becket, and then his own wife and sons. But now that you know some of the melancholy aspects of Henry's reign in advance, I want to start by saying that he nevertheless achieved astonishing things as king. He manages not only to restore order to this kingdom that's recently ravaged by civil war, he also, in the process of doing that, essentially gives birth to the English common law. The English common law is the foundation of the legal system, not just for Britain, but also for the many current and former members of the British Commonwealth all around the world, and of course, for the United States. So let's look at how he manages to do this, while at the same time he has to fight off all these serious challenges to his rule from within his innermost circle. Now, in order to understand this, it helps to understand a little bit about his character. Like many members of the Angevin family, Henry was rather hot-tempered. Everybody knew about the famous Angevin temper. Henry could be given to ungovernable rages. He had a tendency to throw himself on the ground and gnaw on the rushes. Now, the way things worked in the Middle Ages is you didn't really have carpets. That would have been too expensive to put a beautiful piece of work on the ground. You would strew rushes on the ground, these plants that you would put on the ground, and they were meant to absorb all little bits of food and other less pleasant things that would fall on the ground, and when they were all dirty, you would sweep them away and bring in new ones. And so Henry would fall on the ground and gnaw on the rushes to express his displeasure with whatever had angered him. Now, the king also has phenomenal energy, and this is a huge asset for a ruler in this period, because as we've seen, the king really has to go around and show himself in person as much as possible. Otherwise, people are just not going to obey him. And people were very impressed by this ability of Henry's to do this. King Louis VII of France famously says of Henry in astonishment, The King of England is now in Ireland, now in England, now in Normandy. He seems rather to fly than to go by horse or ship. Now, Henry also has a very vigorous notion of the rights of kings, even with regard to the church. And this is something we're going to see play out in this lecture on a very grand scale. So if we want to sum up Henry, he's a man to be reckoned with. As long as he's your friend, he's a very good friend. But he's a very dangerous enemy. Now, when Henry came to the throne of England in 1154, he's a very young man. He's only 21 years old. He's already Duke of Normandy, and he's also Count of Anjou in France. And he's newly married to Eleanor of Aquitaine, the greatest heiress in France, and the former wife of King Louis VII of France, which is a very interesting story that I'm going to tell you in the next lecture. Now, through Eleanor, Henry also controls almost all of southwestern France. So it's a good thing that Henry is notoriously vigorous, even restless, because he has a huge task before him that is going to take him to almost every corner of England, not to mention all these vast lands in France, because it's Henry's job to restore order after nearly two decades of conflict in England. Now, the task before the new king is a very daunting one. As I said, for nearly two decades, central authority in England has been severely undermined. You have parties of Stephen and Matilda battling across the countryside. Of course, some regions are much more severely affected than others, but everywhere you have local barons and lords taking advantage of the fact that the king's attention is elsewhere. So these barons have taken over royal castles. They've built many new castles that are in their own personal control. Now, these unauthorized castles are known as adulterine castles because they're illegitimate in the eyes of the king. They're not authorized. And this is a very dangerous situation for the crown. The kings of England had always tried to keep the number of castles in England, the ones not in royal hands, to an absolute minimum. This is because it's relatively easy, if you have a castle, to defy the king. You have got a strong base. Now, in this period, warfare definitely favors the defense because it's very hard to keep a besieging army in the field for long enough to starve out the garrison of a castle. And if the English kings want to see what this looks like, they just have to look at France. The French kings were constantly having to deal with barons rebelling. They would hole up in their castles and just defy royal orders. So when Henry takes the throne in 1154, one of the first things he wants to do is to deal with those adulterine castles. He wants to make sure he is not going to have to face the same problems as the French kings. Now, to do this, Henry has to go around systematically to all of the questionable castles and demand their surrender into royal hands. For example, he marches north, and he breaks the power of the Count of Aumale. The Count had been ruling virtually unchecked in Yorkshire. Henry recovers the northern castles of Newcastle-upon-Tyne, Bamborough, Carlisle. All of these actually were being held at this point by the King of Scotland. So it's very important to get them back into English hands. And the result is that dozens of castles revert to royal control, particularly ones like Carlisle. These are of strategic importance in defending the borders of England. The castles that he doesn't think he needs for strategic purposes, he just razes to the ground so that they aren't a problem for him internally in the future. Now, Henry also set about recovering not just castles, but other things that had slipped out of control during the Civil War, particularly royal lands. Stephen had made many grants of royal lands, and this was simply to have something to bribe people with to keep his supporters on board. In addition, many royal estates that were supposed to be merely leased out to tenants are now being treated de facto as private property. People sort of forget that they're renting them. They sort of act as if they own them. And Henry sets out to change all that. He declares that all charters granted by Stephen were invalid, and he sets about recovering royal lands, and they actually add up to £3,000 worth of lands, and this is a significant addition to the royal revenues. I think the theme here is clear. Henry is trying to undo the Civil War. He wants to restore the throne to the status it had under the rule of his grandfather, Henry I. And Henry mentions his grandfather all the time in his charters. He's trying almost to pretend that the reign of Stephen, the whole Civil War, that it never happened at all. But if Henry had only fixed what came undone during the Civil War, he wouldn't be remembered as one of the greatest kings in English history, which he is. For Henry went beyond getting rid of illegitimate castles. He went beyond getting royal lands back under royal control. He changed the whole way in which the royal administration worked. He changed the way people viewed justice in England. He began the development of the system that came to see justice as radiating from the royal courts, not from the point of a sword, as it often had during the anarchy, but from the royal courts. And thus, we can give him a certain amount of credit for a fostering acceptance of the rule of law. And that's obviously an indispensable building block for the kind of prosperous and free and orderly society that the civilizations that descended from medieval England enjoy today. So how does this come about? Well, one of the big problems during the Civil War had been that people who had problems with each other over land or some other issue had simply taken matters into their own hands and fought it out, since the king was often too busy to help. And this is a self-help style of justice. We've talked about this in the past, and it sort of made a comeback during the anarchy. And that could obviously lead to a lot of disorder in the countryside. It created long-standing feuds, and these could trickle down the social hierarchy from top to bottom. And many people agreed that this was not an efficient way to solve disputes, and King Henry decided to do something about this. He decided to make it more attractive for people to settle their disputes in the royal courts. And he did this by devising a series of standardized writs. And these writs gave people clear and guaranteed access to recognized procedures in the royal courts. And at least in theory, these writs would be tailored to addressing whatever concern they had. So let me talk a little bit about these writs. We've encountered writs before, but they so far have been very ad hoc affairs. You could get a writ from the king if you happen to catch his attention. But the king is a moving target, as we've seen, and you have to find him, and you have to lay out the specifics of your case to him, and then you have to hope he's going to grant you one of these writs, which he has to customize for your particular situation, and you're going to have to pay for that privilege. Absolutely. But what if the whole system could be streamlined? What if, instead of having to deal with each case individually, there were a standard formula for the most common kinds of disputes, a sort of Form 1A and Form 1B that you could fill in whenever a petitioner showed up, whether the king is there in person or not? That's exactly what Henry II's legal advisors came up with. They devised a series of standardized writs that addressed some of the most frequent kinds of legal disputes. And this lowered the cost of the writs. There's a kind of a volume discount that can be applied, and it streamlines the whole process of getting the dispute dealt with. And I'll talk about two of the most famous kinds of writs, but there were also others. The most important writ that Henry II devised was the writ of novel disseisin. Now, what does that mean, novel disseisin? First of all, it's not a Latin term. It's French, because that's the language still being spoken by the elite classes, and these are the ones likely to be suing each other. The word novel means, not surprisingly, new or recent. The word disseisin takes a little bit more explaining, because if you want to understand what disseisin is, you have to understand what season is. Disseisin means depriving someone of season. And season basically means possession. So if you're in season of a particular piece of property, it means you're holding it. You are actually in possession of it. It doesn't say anything about whether you have a right to hold that land. It merely means you have it currently. Now, what was happening all over England was that people were perpetually having arguments about who had the right to a piece of property. This was very frequent in medieval England. We talked about this in an earlier lecture. We described ways people tried to remember the details of property transactions. You know, there's the boundary stone, there's the stream, but Boundary stones could move, sometimes accidentally, sometimes on purpose. Streams could change their courses. Many times, one person would simply show up at the disputed property with a gang of toughs, and they'd kick out the other person from his holding. Now, if you've ever heard the expression, possession is nine-tenths of the law, you get the idea. You're in a much stronger position if you actually have seizin of the disputed property than if you don't. So what the new writ of novel disseisin is designed to do is to stop people from taking this kind of advantage of their opponents in a land dispute. If someone has done this to you, that is, if someone has disseised you of your property, you can now go to the king's court, get a writ of novel disseisin, for which you would pay 2 pence, a bargain. Then you'd take it to the sheriff of the county where the land is. He was instructed in the writ to disseise the disseiser, so to speak. The sheriff would thus be restoring the status quo, and then the case could be decided on the merits. There would often still have to be lengthy legal proceedings. They might not be terminated by a trial by battle, and that would determine who actually had the right to the land. But in the meantime, order would have been restored. Now, these writs proved enormously popular. They practically flew off the shelves, and I think that gives you a sense of how much disseising is going on in England. It's clearly a lot cheaper to buy one of these writs than to go out and hire your own gang of toughs to get rid of your opponent. Why not let the sheriff take care of that part? The next most popular writ after novel disseisin is the writ of mort d'ancestor, which literally means death of your ancestor or predecessor. And this is a writ you could get if your lord had blocked you from your rightful inheritance. And the writ asked the sheriff to convene a jury of 12 lawful men, and they would decide who was the nearest heir, and then the sheriff would put that person in possession. And this was a way of stopping lords from denying the right of their tenants to pass down their holdings to their heirs. Now, in practice, it's pretty easy for a local jury to determine who the heir is. You know the families around you. But the point of the writ is to guarantee that the normal channels of inheritance would function. Now, the reason these writs are so popular is not just that they're cheap, and it's obviously safer to use them than the self-help methods. It's that they make people with property feel secure. They begin to trust that if they hold their land today, they're going to hold it tomorrow. And it reinforces the sense that the ultimate source of that security is the law, specifically the king's law. And this gives the propertied classes a stake in the established order. And that ultimately proves crucial to the development of English government. And we'll have a lot more to say about that in the lectures to follow. But I promised to talk about English common law in this lecture. So far, I've only dealt with what we would think of as civil law, the law of property and dispute settlement. But Henry II is also determined to reform the criminal law. He wants to crack down not just on barons and lords who are disseising each other, but also on garden variety criminals. Now, in an earlier lecture, we heard that Henry I's reign was a period when someone could travel around England with silver and gold and not be molested. Remember how much Henry II wants to be thought of as the heir of his grandfather. He wants that sort of thing said about his reign, too. So to that end, he sets about reforming the royal approach to crime. He sends out roving commissions of judges called heirs, and these heirs are specifically tasked with sweeping up criminals and trying their cases. We're not going to wait for the cases to come to us. We're going to go out and find the criminals. He increased the royal supervision of private jurisdiction, that is, courts run by barons on their own lands. He wants to make sure they're doing things properly. And he went after a group of people who he considered to be threats to public order. And the reason they were is because they tended to escape from royal jurisdiction altogether. And it might surprise you to learn that this class of troublemakers are clergymen, or clerks, to use the term they used in the 12th century. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're priests. There are many grades in the clerical hierarchy in those days. Men could work their way slowly up these grades, and they would live still very much like laymen. And in the lower grades, they might even be married. So there are lots of these men floating around. They're technically churchmen, but they're not really living very church-oriented lives. And some of them are scraping by on very low salaries, or sometimes no salary at all. And a few are clearly supplementing their earnings with crime. Now, once upon a time, before the Norman conquest, this would not have been a controversial issue at all. A criminis clerk, that's what you call these clerical criminals, a criminis clerk would just be tried for his crimes like anybody else. But William the Conqueror had brought into England a parallel court system that was run by the church. And these church courts had jurisdiction over certain kinds of cases, particularly those related to marriage. That was something that the church should take care of. But they also had jurisdiction over certain kinds of people, namely anybody in clerical orders, even these very low orders, like acolyte. In practice, the secular courts and the church courts had worked out a way of getting along over the years by which clerks accused of really serious crimes first would be stripped of their clerical status in the church courts. Now you're not a cleric anymore. Then they would be handed over to the royal courts for further punishment. Now the reason for this is that church courts are not allowed to be involved in the shedding of blood. That's something that polluted the church. So you couldn't do executions, you couldn't do mutilations. If you wanted those, you have to go to the royal court. But this whole system of working things out between the two courts was just run on custom. There aren't any hard and fast written rules about when exactly the church courts are obliged to cough up particular criminis clerks to the royal courts. And Henry II is determined to regularize this aspect of the law. He's doing this everywhere in his administration. He wants to do this here as well. And there were several big clerical scandals at this period that sort of pushed him in this direction. And I'll just tell you about one of them. In 1163, a canon of Bedford named Philip de Bois was accused of murdering a knight. And he was brought before the archbishop's court, and he purged himself of the crime. That is, he swore on oath that he had not committed the crime, and the oath was accepted. And that's all it took in the church court. He got off scot-free. Later, a royal judge tried to reopen the case. Apparently, there were many grounds for thinking that this oath was not exactly sincere. And Philip then insulted the royal judge before witnesses. And this was, if anything, a more serious crime than the murder. You're actually disrespecting the king by doing that. So he's hauled up before the archbishop's court again. This time he's convicted of insulting the judge, but again he's acquitted of the murder, and he gets off with a very light sentence for insulting the judge. The secular penalty for that would have been death. And the king is outraged. Henry is utterly fed up with clerks being able to get away with murder, literally. Now, the target of the king's anger is the man who presided over that court, namely the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket. Now, there are lots of controversies about Becket. I'll do my best to deal with them. The first thing I want to clear up is the controversy about his name. Many people have heard him referred to as Thomas à Becket. Now, this is something that nobody said until the 16th century. It was not used in Becket's lifetime. And even the name Becket is not used much, at least by Thomas himself. You see, Thomas is the son of a London merchant named Gilbert Becket. He was a Norman immigrant. He was of relatively humble social status. Becket is not a noble name, and everybody knows that. And once Thomas has made his way up the social ladder a few rungs, he doesn't want to be reminded of his non-noble origins, so usually he calls himself simply Thomas of London. That's what it says on his seal. If people want to needle him, they call him Thomas Becket on purpose. But I don't mean any disrespect. I'm just going to use the name because we're used to it. So if Thomas doesn't owe his high position in the church to noble birth, which a lot of people did in this period, a lot of people are archbishops or bishops because of their families, how does he get to the top of the clerical hierarchy? Well, he's not rich, he's not well connected, at least to start with. He's not even exceptionally brilliant. Many people around him are clearly smarter than he is. Instead, he owes his phenomenal rise to charm, good looks, and ambition. Now, if you imagine Thomas Becket as Richard Burton, like in the film Becket, you're probably not far off, because he's certainly dark-haired and handsome. He has a magnetic fascination for those around him, and one of those people is the young king, Henry II. Henry notices Becket early in his reign. At that time, Becket is a clerk in the household of Theobald, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And the king makes Becket his chancellor, the keeper of his records. It's a very powerful position, but even more than that, Henry makes Becket his friend. Becket is about a decade older than the king, but they seem to have a lot in common. They love hunting, they love hawking, they love all sorts of outdoor pursuits, and they love a good party. And we have accounts of them spending lots of their time together outside of business hours. In short, they're best friends. So much so that when Archbishop Theobald dies in 1161, Henry passes over the obvious choice to replace him. There's a very capable guy waiting in the wings, the Bishop of London, Gilbert Folliot. Instead, Henry names his friend Thomas Becket to the post. And that's where things went wrong. Why? Now, I want to tread lightly here because Thomas Becket is a saint, after all. But in the context of a course on medieval England, I think the thing we need to remember is that Becket was extremely controversial in his own lifetime. People's opinions about him varied a lot. The members of his inner circle are devoted to him, but if you read between the lines of some of the things they wrote, you can tell that a lot of them thought he brought his problems on himself. And there were lots of people who were outright hostile to Becket. One chronicler, a monk in Normandy who wrote just before Becket was murdered, called Becket the chief villain of Henry's reign. And one of Becket's very powerful detractors is the Bishop of London, the very learned, very savvy Gilbert Folliot. He says of Becket in frustration after he'd done something particularly provocative to annoy the king, Folliot said of Becket, "He's a fool and he'll always be a fool." Now, of course, Gilbert is the one who had been all set to become Archbishop of Canterbury, and Becket got the job instead. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the Bishop of London is wrong here. So let's find out if there's anything to justify Gilbert Folliot's judgment. Now, shortly after Becket becomes Archbishop in 1162, the relationship between the king and the Archbishop sours. One reason seems to be they have very different expectations of what their roles are going to be under these changed circumstances. Henry thought now he's going to have a tame Archbishop. He'd be his man. After all, Thomas owes him everything. Thomas, on the other hand, seems to feel like now, at last, he's got an independent power base, and he's not going to have to dance to the king's tune anymore. The Church of Canterbury is very powerful, and Becket's going to do everything he can to protect that power base. He's going to draw a firm line in the sand whenever the rights and privileges of Canterbury are threatened in any way, even by his former best friend, the king. So when Henry goes after Crimina's clerks, the Archbishop pushes back. And this leads the king to try to spell out in detail exactly when and how the church was obliged to hand these clerks over to the secular courts. There had been this informal working arrangement, but now it's going to be a written obligation. And so the king produces this document in 1164, the Constitutions of Clarendon. And these obliged the church to hand Crimina's clerks over to be tried by the royal courts. And Becket was summoned before the royal presence and forced, probably literally under the threat of violence, to accept this renunciation of the church's rights of jurisdiction. But after he does this, after he accepts the constitutions, he makes all the other bishops accept them, and then he changes his mind, and he decides to defy the king. He decides to take a stand, and he renounces the constitutions of Clarendon. This enrages his fellow bishops. He has made them go against their consciences in accepting the constitutions. Now he's going back on his word. He's trying to have it both ways. And he loses a lot of support among the bishops right there. Now, there's an uneasy truce with the king at this point, but Thomas and Henry just can't stop provoking each other. Little disputes over church property get magnified out of all proportion, and finally the king decides he's going to bring Becket down for good. He accuses him of financial improprieties during his term as chancellor, and he summons him to appear before him at Northampton. Apparently a very large sum of money that the king had given to Thomas, £30,000, can't be accounted for. Nobody knows what happened to this money. Was it a gift? Or did Thomas spend it in the royal service? We'll never know. And it's very likely that the whole affair is really a put-up job. It's meant to get rid of Becket. The charge is serious enough that the archbishop feels he has no option but to flee. He doesn't want to be treated publicly like a criminous clerk. So he escapes from Northampton with a few followers. There's a harrowing cross-country journey. It takes him 3 weeks to finally make it to the coast. He goes to the port of Sandwich, which is under the Archbishop of Canterbury's control in the south, and he leaves for exile on the continent. And it's going to be 6 years before he comes back to England. 6 years of fruitless negotiations. They involve not just the king and the archbishop, but also the king of France, the pope, almost every important secular and religious leader in Western Europe. All of them are involved in trying to solve this dispute between Becket and the king. And in the next lecture, we'll find out what happened when Becket finally went home.
Lecture 17, Henry II, The Expansion of Empire.
Welcome back. I left you in suspense in our last lecture because Thomas Becket and Henry II had just patched up their quarrel, and Becket was headed home to England at last after 6 years of exile. What happened next? Well, we're going to find out in this lecture, I promise, and we're going to see that Becket's fate is tied to the subject that we're going to spend the rest of the lecture on, the expansion of English rule under Henry II, and the very complicated intertwining of the personal and the political throughout his reign, but especially in the second half of the reign when Henry's sons grew up. So we are going to get to Becket later in the lecture, but first I'm going to back up to a point even before he became king so we can understand how Henry ended up ruling so much territory, so much land, that some historians call it the Angevin Empire. Well, Henry acquired his lands in three main ways: by inheritance, by marriage, and by conquest. Now, from his mother, Empress Matilda, he had inherited his claim to Normandy and, of course, to England. And Normandy was solidly controlled by the Angevins by the time Henry was a young teenager, thanks to the work of his father, Geoffrey of Anjou. Geoffrey, you'll remember, had preferred to concentrate on Normandy. He never bothered to get interested in England. England, of course, young Henry had had to fight for, though he ultimately got it due to this compromise we talked about last time with King Stephen. So that's Henry's maternal inheritance. This is the original territory controlled by William the Conqueror, Henry's great-grandfather, and then by Henry's grandfather, Henry I. But Henry also has a paternal inheritance from his father, Geoffrey of Anjou. Geoffrey died suddenly in 1151 at the age of 39. And from Geoffrey, Henry inherits the county of Anjou, along with the counties of Maine and the Touraine. And taken together, the lands Henry inherits from his mother and father in France, they constitute an enormous contiguous lordship that dominates northwestern France. But that's not all. In 1152, Henry accomplishes a masterstroke that makes him ruler of almost all of the western seaboard of France. He marries Eleanor of Aquitaine, the newly divorced ex-queen of France. And I promise I will give you the juicy details later in the lecture. But for right now, I just want to point out that by this marriage, Henry acquires rights over Aquitaine and Poitou. And that's essentially all of southwestern France. And finally, to complete the western seaboard, later on, Henry marries his third son, Geoffrey, to the heiress of the county of Brittany. So by inheritance and by marriage, Henry rules basically half of France as well as the Kingdom of England. Henry also acquires land by conquest. And here I'm talking about the famous Norman conquest of Ireland, though the term doesn't really make sense anymore. You don't really want to call these people Normans. They rule over so many different territories. Now, the story of the conquest of Ireland is very complicated, but one essential point to grasp, I think, is that it's never all that important to Henry, certainly not in comparison to any of his other lands. But here, in a nutshell, is what happened. Ireland in the 1160s is divided among many, many warring kings. None of them really controls the whole island. One of these kings, Dermot of Leinster, is driven into exile. He loses out in a faction fight. There are two more powerful rulers. He's backing the loser. So he's already in contact with lords in England and Wales when this happens, and he decides he's going to try to get English help to put himself back on the throne. So Dermot tracks down King Henry II. At this point, Henry is in Aquitaine, and Dermot comes to ask for support. But Henry puts him off. He has his hands full. But the king does give Dermot permission to go see if any of Henry's other lords might be willing to help out on a private basis. Now, Dermot tries a lot of lords in vain. There's not a whole lot of interest in this venture, but finally he has success in Wales. Wales is full of restless, enterprising noblemen referred to as marcher lords. Since the days of William the Conqueror, Anglo-Norman lords had been pushing into Wales, establishing lordships at the expense of the native Welsh, and the areas that they control are on the border between English and Welsh territory. A border is referred to in this period as a march, so marcher lords are border lords. There were also Scottish marches on the borders between England and Scotland. Now, the marcher lords are a fairly tough lot, and they have to be because their position in Wales is always rather precarious. The Welsh fought back, of course, and sometimes these marcher lords would lose out to the Welsh. They would actually lose their new lordships. So for them, it might be a good idea to have other outlets for their energies. Maybe Ireland might be a promising avenue to explore. One lord in particular, a guy named Richard Fitzgilbert de Clare, is happy to take up Dermot's offer, and we'll call him Strongbow because that's the nickname that he got later on. The terms were very attractive. Dermot promises Strongbow that in return for helping Dermot get back on the throne, Strongbow will have the right to marry Dermot's daughter, Aoife, and he will inherit the kingdom of Leinster when Dermot dies. And so you see a series of invasions of Ireland starting in 1167, and gradually these invasions restored Dermot's position there until, in 1171, he and Strongbow have managed to make Dermot more powerful in Ireland than he had ever been before. At that point, Henry II gets involved at last. He hadn't necessarily expected that Dermot's plea for help would be answered so successfully, and he wasn't at all sure that he's going to be able to keep a lid on the Welsh marcher lords once they've established a secure power base in Ireland. It's a little bit far off the beaten track, and maybe they will be a little bit more independent than the King of England is comfortable with. These marcher lords could be rather fickle in their loyalties, and they're used to a lot of freedom of maneuver, much more freedom than lords in the other parts of Henry's dominions. The English kings had had to give them a certain amount of headroom so that they could survive in the very difficult conditions on the Welsh border. So Henry doesn't trust these lords. He doesn't trust Strongbow. And so he comes to Ireland in person in 1171 to make sure that from now on, everybody knows that the king is ultimately in charge there. He's coming in at the last minute. Sure, he hasn't really done any of the work, but he's rebranding the invasion of Ireland. He's turning it from a private venture into a royal venture. And thus, the lordship of Ireland is created. And we see the beginning of the very long, very contentious history of England's connection to Ireland. Now, the result of all of this, inheriting and marrying and conquering, is that Henry is in charge of an astonishing conglomeration of territories. Think about trying to control all of this land under the conditions of the 12th century. Henry has Ireland, he has England, he has half of France under his control, at least in theory. But in reality, the degree of royal control in each of these areas varies a lot. Many historians like to talk about an Angevin empire, but there isn't a real sense in which this is an empire like the Roman Empire. There isn't an integrated administration at all. These are territories with their own traditions, their own institutions of government, or not. In the case of Ireland, there's hardly any government in Ireland. They have their own peoples, they have their own languages, they have their own customs. And really, the only thing that unites them is the accident that they're ruled by this one man, Henry II. So let's talk a little bit about these divisions. And we'll start with Ireland, we'll move across England, and then into France. Ireland is never completely conquered in the Middle Ages. The English certainly establish a secure foothold there, but their authority never extends over the whole country. There are areas in the south and the east that are quite anglicized. These are places where you have a lot of settlers come in. They establish new towns, and it all looks rather English. But there are also parts of the north and the west where hardly any English settlers go. The Irish kings and chieftains are still ruling pretty much the way they'd always done. In between these areas, there are marches, just as there are in Wales. And these are places where the Irish and the English have to work out ways of getting along with each other, though there's frequent conflict. So Ireland's not an area that is securely held by Henry II or by any other medieval English king. Ireland is always a problem. Now, in this context, we don't really need to talk much about England. We know from our last lecture what Henry's administration in England is like in this period. He's getting an increasingly firm grip on law and order in England, and it's a relatively well-governed territory, certainly. But what about France? Here I think the most important point to make is that Henry's French lands are almost as different from one another as France is from England, and in one respect probably more so. France is broadly divided into two main cultural and linguistic zones. The zone in the north is called the Languedoc, and the zone in the south is called the Languedoc. And these two names come from the two different words for yes. In the two regions. In the south, for yes, you said oc, and in the north, you said oil, which over time became the modern French oui. And the northern term ends up winning out because of the way politics develop in France. The north ends up dominating the south. Now, both oc and oil, they both come from a similar Latin derivation, but it's just that the two different regions of France chose a different part of the Latin word that they took it from. And these words for yes are by no means the only points of difference between the two languages. They really are separate languages. They're actually not all that mutually intelligible. So you actually are speaking a different language in the south than you are in the north. In addition, northerners and southerners tend to have different legal systems. For example, take inheritance. The northern lands are more likely to practice primogeniture. That is, they reserve the main inheritance for the oldest son. Certainly, there's more of an emphasis in the north on passing down larger parcels of land. In the south, people tend to divide up their holdings more among different brothers. And the result is that in the north, you see larger, more compact lordships. In the south, there are lots of little lordships, and things are, as a result, just a lot more chaotic overall. On the legal front, there's also a big difference. Normandy and England use customary law. As we've seen, the common law is being developed in England, and there's an emphasis slowly emerging on precedent and case law, and this is true in Normandy also. In southern France, they're actually still using the old Roman law, and this had never completely died out after the fall of the Roman Empire. So the legal systems of the two main regions of France that were ruled by Henry II are incompatible. So overall then, not a lot of basis for unity. You don't have culture going for you, you don't have language, you don't have law. And predictably, these areas are fiercely independent. We've seen in the past that the Normans hate the Angevins. This is why the barons in England and Normandy don't want Matilda to marry Geoffrey of Anjou in the first place. And things actually get worse after Geoffrey of Anjou uses rather brutal methods to conquer Normandy. The Normans really hate the Angevins after that. And both Normans and Angevins hate the people of Poitou, the Poitevins. One constant theme in English history from now on, down through the 14th century, is that everybody hated the Poitevins. They were just seen as treacherous schemers who were always getting in the way. And then there's Aquitaine. Aquitaine was a real headache to govern. Every little lordship in Aquitaine was fiercely independent. It was resistant to the authority even of their own dukes. So what on earth is Henry II's plan for trying to govern this huge mess? Well, as we've seen, he's a man with a lot of self-confidence. And his plan is basically that he personally is going to keep a lid on all of these territories as long as he's alive. And then he's going to divide them up among his sons when he dies. His sons will get manageable chunks of territory that are going to be more logical units to govern. He has a large family to provide for. He and his wife Eleanor have 4 sons and 3 daughters who live to adulthood. But Henry seems to have a lot of land in order to take care of this. So what exactly is his master plan? First, the daughters. They're not going to get any land. They're going to be married off to important royal figures. One goes to Germany, one goes to Spain, one goes to Sicily. It's the sons who are going to inherit. And so you have these 4 young men, Henry, Richard, Geoffrey, and John, and they dominate Henry II's planning. And they end up making him absolutely miserable. But before we get to the misery, let's look at how Henry II thought it was going to turn out. His first son, Henry, is the oldest, and by this point, it's customary for the oldest son to get the lands that belong to his father by inheritance. So in the case of Henry II, that would be England, Normandy, and Anjou. Henry II's second son, Richard, is going to get his mother's lands in Poitou and Aquitaine. Now we have to take care of the third son, Geoffrey. And Henry II is going to take care of him by marrying him off to the heiress of Brittany. He's going to rule in Brittany, and that'll be a pretty decent holding for a third son. Now, when Henry II first devises this scheme for providing for all his sons, the youngest son, John, hadn't been born yet. So when he came along, there was nothing left over, and people mockingly referred to him as John Lackland, because he didn't have any land set aside for him, at least at first. And incidentally, John Lackland is at least a better nickname than the one he got later on, John Softsword. But King Henry found a solution to the problem. When Ireland came under English control, King Henry made John Lord of Ireland. Problem solved. Now, this seems like a pretty reasonable plan, and it might have worked if it weren't for the fact that the Angevin royal family was one of the most dysfunctional families in all of English royal history. And they have competition on this point, but still I think they absolutely take the cake. And it really starts with the very volatile relationship between Henry II and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine. Now, so far, I've put off describing Eleanor, but now it's time, finally, to fulfill my promise of explaining why Eleanor is such a formidable figure that only Katharine Hepburn can possibly do her justice on the screen. Eleanor had quite a history before she became Queen of England. In the 1130s, she was the most eligible heiress in France. She's the granddaughter of the famous Duke William IX of Aquitaine. He was a troubadour poet in his own right, and a renowned bon vivant. Eleanor had been married at an early age to Louis VII of France, just before Louis inherited the throne from his father, Louis the Fat. Now, Louis VII was his father's opposite in many ways. He was not fat. Instead, he was quite ascetic. And some people thought that Louis was more suited to the cloister than the battlefield. And Eleanor and Louis were clearly unsuited to each other. Eleanor loved music and poetry and parties. Louis didn't. There were other things Eleanor apparently liked more than Louis did, and it's largely in an effort to keep an eye on her that Louis brings Eleanor with him on the Second Crusade. And her behavior on Crusade caused something of a scandal. There were rather public displays of affection between Eleanor and her uncle, Raymond of Antioch, and people gossiped quite a bit about that. Louis hustled Eleanor back home, and a few years later, they were divorced. Now, the ostensible grounds for the divorce were consanguinity, and that means the spouses were too closely related for the marriage to be legal in the eyes of the church. And this was a relatively common pretext for divorce in the 12th century. Officially, you were not allowed to marry somebody related to you within 7 degrees of kinship. And that means you're not allowed to marry your sixth cousin. But almost all of the noble and royal families of Europe at this point were closely related to each other. It could be very hard to find somebody who you wanted to marry because they were rich enough and important enough, but who wasn't related to you too closely at the same time. In practice, many marriages went ahead, even if they were technically incestuous. And this could leave a convenient escape clause for later, and that's what happened with Louis and Eleanor. The real practical reason for the divorce was the fact that Eleanor had produced 2 daughters, but no sons. And King Louis wanted an heir. Now, we know from what I've said already earlier in the lecture that Eleanor has no trouble producing sons later with her second husband, Henry II. But I think that it's pretty clear to all concerned at the royal court of France that there aren't going to be any more offspring from Louis and Eleanor. Because the spouses just can't stand each other, and they cannot bear to do their dynastic duty. And so, in this situation, divorce is the best option. And this is the case even though it means that Louis is going to lose control of Eleanor's vast inheritance, which shows you how bad things were. But Louis does not see Eleanor's next move coming, clearly, or he would never have risked the divorce before having some suitable second husband for Eleanor lined up. That's probably what he was planning to do, eventually marry her off to somebody else. Because Eleanor turned around immediately after the divorce and married Henry of Anjou, the future Henry II. And really, there's no better way of getting back at Louis than that, because the Angevins and the King of France are, of course, bitter rivals. The French kings don't like the fact that the English kings have these huge landholdings in France. And also, technically, the English kings owe homage to the French kings for their French lands, and they don't like that. In practice, they don't have to listen to the French kings very much, but it definitely rankles with them that technically they are their overlords. So now, here comes Henry of Anjou. He swoops in, he gets Aquitaine and Poitou. 2 years later, he's King of England as well. And this is a very bitter pill for Louis of France to swallow. But let's turn our attentions away from poor King Louis to the royal couple themselves. And these are 2 fascinating, ambitious individuals. At the time of the marriage, Eleanor is over a decade older than Henry. She's an experienced woman. She's been Queen of France for 15 years. And I think the two of them were united in their ambition for power. And for about the first 15 years of their marriage, things seemed to have worked fairly well. They produced 8 children, 7 of whom survived, which is a very good rate for the 12th century. And it's especially impressive when we consider that Eleanor is about 30 when they get married, and still she has 8 more children. In these early years, Henry clearly relied on Eleanor. On several occasions, she served as regent in one area of his dominions while he campaigned in another. But things seem to have gone wrong shortly after the birth of their last child, John, in 1167. After that point, Eleanor is permanently replaced in the king's affections by a series of mistresses. Now, this is not a period when there's any realistic expectation that kings are going to be absolutely faithful in marriage. But I think what Eleanor minds is that she's being ignored. She isn't used to it, and she seems to have taken her revenge by fostering plots among her sons so as to get back at their father. But I want to leave Eleanor on one side for a moment, beginning her schemes, to return to the subject that we started the lecture with, namely, how does all of this dynastic politics relate to the controversy between Henry II and Thomas Becket? Now, most of the very thorny issues between Henry and Becket, all of this constitutional and jurisdictional stuff, most of that had been straightened out by early in 1170. But then another controversy arose, and this time it had to do directly with Henry's dynastic plans. Henry wanted his oldest son, called Henry, to be crowned King of England even while he himself was still alive. And this would be kind of an insurance policy that he will succeed peacefully when the time came, because he'll already be king, of course. Now, remember, the successions of all of the other English kings since the Norman conquest have been rather dicey. Think about Henry I having to sprint to Winchester to get the royal treasury, or Stephen having to hurry across the channel to do the same thing. Henry II wants his son to have an easier path to the throne. And in order to get his son crowned, he needs the Archbishop of Canterbury. Remember all the back and forth about who's going to consecrate various kings? You really want the Archbishop of Canterbury to do it, if you can possibly pull that off, because that's going to look the best. But if you can't settle your disputes with the Archbishop of Canterbury in time, there's another archbishop in England, the Archbishop of York. You can get him to do it. So on June 14th, 1170, Prince Henry is crowned in Westminster Abbey by the Archbishop of York. And after that, he's usually referred to as Henry the Young King, because he's already a king. Now, when Becket finds out about the coronation, he's devastated. This is a blow at one of Canterbury's most cherished prerogatives, the right to consecrate the king. But he swallows hard, and he makes up the quarrel between himself and the king. I don't think they quite understood what each other was saying when they settled the quarrel. Becket thought that the king is giving him permission to punish the bishops who were involved in the coronation. Henry did not think he was doing that. At any rate, it seemed like peace. But in the meantime, letters arrive from the Pope imposing sentence on the bishops who had been involved in the consecration. Becket forwarded the letters to England and crossed the channel himself, and clearly his intent was to follow up personally. He was going to go after those bishops. And this was the final straw. When Henry learned that Becket was going to go after the men who had consecrated his son, King of England, he snapped. He was in Normandy when he got the news, and he is reported to have burst out in anger with a very famous leading question. He asked, "Will no one rid me of this turbulent priest?" Now, four knights in his entourage heard this and said to themselves, in effect, "Well, we will." And off they went, across Normandy, over the Channel, to Canterbury to create a martyr. Now, they probably didn't go with the intention of murdering Becket. But when he resisted their attempts to coerce him, they cut him down right in his cathedral. And overnight, Becket went from first-class troublemaker to saint. Now, King Henry tried in vain to argue that he hadn't ordered the knights to kill Becket. "Well, they misunderstood me." Everybody basically accepted that he was ultimately responsible for the deed. Now, in a strange way, Becket's murder is tied up in the king's dynastic plans, not just because it was partly caused by this controversy over the young Henry's coronation, but for another reason as well. Henry II is all of a sudden in the very bad graces of the Pope. He wants to get out of town, and he wants to seem as if he's doing something that the Pope will approve of in the process. And it's just at this moment that the Irish expedition crops up. Popes had been calling for an invasion of Ireland for a while. Their hope was that the English would be able to impose some sort of discipline on the Irish church, which was famously very undisciplined. And here's a chance for Henry to win brownie points with the Pope and rein in those troublesome marcher lords, as we talked about. So the invasion of Ireland in 1171 was directly tied to Becket's murder. But after Henry II returned from Ireland, he still had to do public penance at Becket's tomb. Now, from the time of Becket's murder in 1170 pretty much until the end of his reign, Henry had very little peace. And it's important to keep this in mind when we remember all of the great administrative and legal accomplishments that we talked about in the last lecture. Those are all going on while Henry deals with blow after blow delivered by his own family. And at the back of them is his bitter wife, Eleanor. And the chief cause of all of these troubles is the dynamic that we've seen before, where you have adult royal children, usually sons. Empress Matilda is the one exception here. You have adult royal children, and they want more authority than the king wishes to consider.